now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Ralph Buchhold. Mr. Buchhold is the appellant, and he is represented by Mr. Brian Utzman, an attorney from Rapid City. The appellee, State of South Dakota, is represented by Mr. Stephen Blair, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Utzman, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
Justices, as indicated, I'm Brian Utzman. I'm representing appellant.
Sorry to mispronounce your name.
That's okay. It's a, kind of a tough one. Gets clobbered quite often. I spoke to my client before this oral argument, and he asked me, how are you going to save my life in 30 minutes? That caused me to ponder, because this is a difficult task. What makes it difficult is he's been convicted of, admittedly, what is a heinous crime, that of the incest and repeated incest. The state is likely to repeatedly reference his outrageous statements that his daughter testified that he made, and I think the state would be doing that to try to get you to decide this case based on emotion as opposed to the settled law. The other thing that makes this case difficult is that we have a trial defense attorney who didn't object to motions when he should have, didn't make motions he should have, or that his client requested that he make, particularly a motion to dismiss for violation of the 180-day rule. He didn't object to evidence. He didn't object to having Mr. Buchhold trotted in front of the jury, shackled in prison garb. I understand that ineffective assistance of counsel has to be raised on habeas relief and can't, except for extraordinary circumstances, be addressed on direct appeal, and that's why I'm focusing on the errors of law. The other mistake that he made is he didn't call an expert witness to try to rebut the state's expert witness. What makes my task a little easier is some of the errors are plain errors. I would like to focus on the 180-day rule violation because I think that's the most plain of all of the errors. And the state has at least tacitly agreed that we have a 180-day rule violation. Where we depart is how to deal with it. The state is essentially asking this court to remand it back to the trial court level to find out why the trial wasn't held within the 180-day time period. Trial was initially set just prior to the expiration of the 180-day rule. It was set for December 15th, 2004. That trial date was continued. The record is completely silent as to why that trial date was continued. The only thing that happened that would have extended that 180-day time period was the defense asked that Judge Tice recuse himself. Judge Davis was reassigned. That took 10 days. I'm sorry, 7 days. The state references 2 days, but I believe it's 7 days. That would extend the trial, the 180-day deadline, to December 28th, 2004. Trial wasn't even set till April 20th, 2005. There were some intervening motions, but the intervening motions were filed well after the December 28th date. If memory serves, it was around January 21st. Of 2005. There were no findings of any good cause made by the trial court. There were no motions brought by the state. There were no motions brought by defense counsel. As indicated previously, the record is completely silent as to why
Did counsel make a motion for judgment of acquittal at the end of the case?
I don't believe he did, no. Nope. And there were discussions about the 180-day rule with the trial court judge, and basically Attorney Groff took the position that, you know, in good conscience, I can't move for a 180-day rule violation, move to dismiss on that basis. Ralph Buckle adamantly wanted him to move for dismissal based on a 180-day violation, but he did not. This court case law is well settled that 180-day waivers can only be done with defendant's concurrence. Attorneys can waive the 180-day rule, but they have to get the consent and concurrence of their client to do so.
Even if the defense attorney is sick and it's not ready to go to trial, which is what I believe Mr. Groff said for justification, correct?
Yeah, and that it's somewhat unclear as to when he was sick. I believe that the record below references later, like March, April, March time frame, that when he was sick, April. But I'm not sure. Like I say, the record's really unclear as to why that was continued. Mr. Buchholz believes that it was continued because the state had some other pressing big notoriety cases around that time period and weren't ready to proceed. But again, the record is silent. That's supposition.
Isn't the record clear, though, that the defense counsel thought the 180-day alleged violation was without merit?
Yes, he took that position.
Isn't that the record that we have to decide this case on?
No, I don't believe so, because he didn't do that with he didn't take that position with the concurrence of his client. He took that position on his own initiative. And this court has stated that it has to be with the concurrence of the client for the waiver to be effective.
So, on the other, your client is saying he should have gone to trial sick and not prepared.
Yes, he should have moved to dismiss because of the 180-day rule violation. Would like to address what, and maybe the state won't take this position or oral argument, but I would like to address the state's position that it should be remanded back to the trial court so the trial court could make determinations as to whether there was good cause to excuse the delay in trying the case. And I'm not sure if the state is envisioning the evidentiary hearing. But that's almost what it would have to come down to, is it'd be some sort of evidentiary hearing where there's a determination as to why the trial date was continued. And that's clearly not in accord with this court's edicts. This court is required that the trial court make particularized findings concerning delay and make an order. The statute also, which is the court's rule, also says the same thing explicitly, that there has to be an order.
I'd like you to address the cruel and unusual punishment issue that you've raised in this court.
Certainly. Mr. Buchholz's position is that the sentence is grossly disproportionate. He was sentenced to 11 maximum terms, and each sentence was to run consecutively, which equates to a 175-year sentence. He's going to die in prison. It's a de facto life sentence.
Was rehabilitation addressed by the trial court or the pre-sentence report?
Rehabilitation wasn't gone into too much. He did not admit that he committed the crimes. In fact, he's adamantly denied that he committed the crimes and still adamantly denies that he committed the crimes today. The person who did the evaluation, his name is escaping me, basically found that he wasn't a danger to other individuals, not likely to act out in a violent manner.
Now, he was 50 years old at the time he was sentenced, is that right?
I think it was 40.
Okay, and then what were his priors before this time? Was there any indication that he had sexually abused anyone else or had any involvement with this kind of a crime previously?
Absolutely not. His only prior record was a theft charge about 10, 15 years previously, but I'm not sure of the date. But no, absolutely no other allegations of crimes of this nature. And there's been no other allegations with any of his other children, too, who were considerably younger.
Did the trial court at the time sentencing, I haven't had a chance to read the transcript yet on the sentencing, if it's in the record, did the trial court make any comments on why the decision to make all of these sentences consecutive?
No. No, I don't believe there was any discussion by the trial court on that point at all. There's other things that occurred that deprived the defendant of a fair trial. I mentioned that he was trotted in front of the jury in prison garbs and shackled. There was also a videotape that was supposed to be redacted to exclude comments that he made to other younger females that could be considered inappropriate. The trial court ruled on a 403B motion that evidence would not be, or testimony would not be admissible. It was shown to the jury through a videotape interview. Part of that statement was redacted, part of it was not. The statements concerning sexual comments were heard by the jury. The other errors that deprived him of a fair trial was prosecutorial misconduct in that the state attorney misstated the evidence repeatedly. He repeatedly stated that there was physical findings that supported Andrea Buchholz's testimony when the state's own witness and the only expert witness testified that they were nonspecific, that there was a hymenal notch, but that there was not suggestive or diagnostic based on the fact that the tissue didn't go all the way down.
But it was consistent with the state's theory.
It was consistent with the testimony of the victim.
So then isn't that just a matter of argument and letting the jury decide
No.
what the witness really meant?
No, I don't believe so, because if there's a physical change in the hymen, which based on what the hymen is condition it's in, it's categorized. Normal, nonspecific, suggestive, or diagnostic are the four categories. Those are purely based on objective findings. She testified that the victim's testimony was consistent with her findings, but she couldn't change her diagnosis or her characterization of her hymenal condition to suggestive or diagnostic based on what she found. State's attorney Brenner described it as a penetrating injury, penile penetration, said there was physical findings when there really wasn't. that's that. And the other things that occurred at trial denied Mr. Buchholz of a fair trial. The other thing I would like to address is his sentence for mutually exclusive crimes. This court has held that sexual contact with a minor at age 16 and third-degree rape, or rape in general, are mutually exclusive crimes. He cannot be convicted of both crimes. That what constitutes, by definition, statutory definition of sexual contact, because it excludes rape, so what constitutes rape cannot be sexual contact.
Were there different dates on those incidents, though? How did the evidence come in?
There was, the evidence was all over the board on dates, and the frequency was all over the board from, you know, once a month to virtually every day during a week.
Well, if there's allegations that occurred every day, how can you claim there were less counts established? Isn't it a question of credibility for the jury, whether they believe the complaining witness?
Because the testimony wasn't definitive enough for the jury to draw a conclusion as to what was sexual contact and what was rape.
Well, sexual contact carries a lesser penalty than rape, correct?
Well, third-degree rape and sexual contact is the same, right? 15 years.
So if they decided it was sexual contact based on her description, it occurred every day versus rape, where's the prejudice to your client?
The prejudice lies in the fact that there were five counts of sexual contact and only five counts of third-degree rape. So the prejudice lies in, even if there's 100 counts, or he committed 100 incidents of third-degree rape over here, there's only five over here, he's only going to get sentenced on the five he's charged with, not the other 95. So the prejudice lies in, if the evidence can't support sexual contact with a minor charge, he's still being convicted of that.
I don't understand your position there. You're saying if there's 105 instances and they take five on rape and five on sexual contact, there's no evidence to support it?
Essentially, yes. Yeah, the evidence, the testimony basically is allegations of rape with some detail, only one incident where there's any testimony with any detail at all about sexual contact with a minor, and that's the first Attorney Brenner, through direct examination, goes through the first incident of abuse, which was touching outside of the clothing in the breast area. And then he elicits testimony from the victim that things got more serious and it jumped straight into the rape. The only other reference at all to what would constitute sexual contact with a minor is a vague reference to hand jobs. There's no testimony was elicited as to what a hand job is. There's no request for judicial notice of what a hand job was. There was nothing else said at all on that point.
Did defense counsel make any motions to get more specificity?
No.
Did he object to testimony that was general and didn't specify dates, times, places, and things?
Not to my knowledge, he didn't know. And that's part of what makes this difficult for me on appeal is defense counsel.
You said when you started, I have not read the record yet, I'm going to have to, but you said in the beginning that there were no objections made. You're saying that during the entire trial, defense counsel never objected to anything?
No, I'm not saying that. I said there were not objections made that should have been made.
Okay.
Right. If there were 100 incidences of rape, do you claim that the state's attorney is barred from charging five at rape as rape and five as sexual contact?
No. If there was 100 incidents of rape, the state's attorney could have charged with 100 counts of rape.
Right. But can't he also charge 5 instances of rape and 5 instances of sexual contact?
Certainly. But what he has to do is, at least our position, what he has to do is prove up his 5 incidences of sexual contact. He can't take the position, well, that's good enough. I showed rape, therefore I don't need to show sexual contact.
Why not? What's the prejudice to your client?
The prejudice is he wasn't charged that way. He didn't have an opportunity to address each and every incident.
So aren't you saying that he was prejudiced because the state undercharged him?
No, I'm saying
it?
He was prejudiced because he was convicted of crimes that the evidence wasn't sufficient to support a conviction on. You know, if they had charged him with all and convicted him of all 5 counts, you know, I couldn't object. If the state had laid out 5 counts of sexual contact,
if there's a rape, can you rape somebody without having sexual contact?
I don't believe so.
No, you can't charge both in the same instance.
Right.
But you don't believe that you can rape somebody without having sexual contact, right?
No, because you'd have to have some penetration. It's however slight, there'd have to be something.
All right. So why can't the state's attorney decide, you know, enough's enough and I'm only going to charge 5 counts of sexual contact?
Well, they can make that decision. They can and they did. What they have to do is prove it, though.
Right. So if they prove, you know, what would you refer to, 95 cases of rape or something like this, or that was an example?
Yeah.
Then haven't they also included therein, haven't they proved 5 cases of sexual contact with a minor?
They would have, except the crimes are, as defined by this court, mutually exclusive. What constitutes rape does not constitute, or what constitutes sexual rape does not and cannot constitute sexual contact by the definition of sexual contact.
It can't constitute both, but it can constitute one or the other if it is rape, right? You're getting me confused here.
If it's rape, it can only be charged and convicted on rape. If it's sexual contact, it's not rape. So no, I don't believe you can. They're mutually exclusive. The evidence has to prove up both crimes.
Yeah, your time is long. It's expired. We might get back into this on rebuttal. But
okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Blair, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Members of the court, counsel, this is a very difficult case, not only because of the facts, but because of the issues. Would have liked to have seen more done with the record that maybe would have cleared up some of these issues. Myself, I find the natural starting point in looking at this case to be the plain error issue. Defendant has overlaid that over much of his arguments. It's the state's position that the 4 issues where plain error is requested, there is simply no error that would allow a plain error review.
On this 180-day issue, your opposing counsel said the state was in favor of remanding for more explicit findings. Is that the state's position?
Actually, my brief and my position here is that there is no error. If the court would decide to review it under the plain error issue, well, plain error doesn't apply to 180 days. I'm sorry. If the court finds that there was an error there, I'm saying the record is too incomplete to just dismiss without allowing the trial court to issue formal findings and conclusions as to why he felt there was no 180-day violation.
Isn't that giving the state a 2 bites of the apple?
I don't think it is.
Why?
Because the trial court, when this issue was brought up by the defense attorney, the trial court made the statement, I don't think there's a 180-day issue here based on a rough computation of time. It's on the record. Then at sentencing, the trial court again prefaced his sentencing comments with a 180-day discussion where he went through and made comments along the lines of, this is a very lengthy case, and he talked about some of the delays that had occurred and who, vague references to who those delays may have been caused by. And so I think it's clear on the record that both defense attorney and the trial court felt that there was no 180-day violation.
How much time was there between the first or the arraignment and the trial?
I believe it was 350 days, I want to say.
Almost a year then.
Almost a year. When you look at it, his arraignment and his original 180-day date would have been in the middle of January. There was some motions that extended that date, I believe, towards like the 20th of January. The original trial date was set for the 15th of December. And that's really, you know, in looking at this issue, the date to focus on. And again, as counsel stated, the record is unfortunately completely silent as to why that date was continued. There's been speculation on both sides, you know, whether it was defense or the state. It's just not clear. The judge makes one comment. I believe it was in the sentencing hearing that the state asked for two continuances. You could read that to be that the December date was requested by the state. However, there's just no evidence in the record.
Was he incarcerated during this time?
I believe he was, and in sentencing he was given credit for that. I think it was, defense counsel probably know better, I think it was 400 days of jail time.
We seem to be getting more and more of these 180-day issues. Is there a problem out there on this?
I would like to, if I were a defense attorney and I think anything looked colorably like a 180-day violation, I would raise it. I can't fault the defense attorneys in the state for bringing these forward. I think in some of our busier jurisdictions, scheduling matters become complicated, and I think when you throw on top of that errors with the record not being as complete as it should, you end up in a lot of 180-day messes. The 180-day statute was originally passed to, I think it was directed mainly at Minnehaha County, to fix scheduling errors. And I think it's gone a long ways to fix that, but I think just the nature of the beast that trial work is, these things arise. Again, I can't fault defense attorneys for raising it. I think in this case, though, there is no clear 180-day violation on the record. I mean, the record's plain that the defense attorney and the trial counsel felt that there was no violation. Without the record plainly showing an error, I don't think plain error review is appropriate of that issue. I would like to turn to what counsel ended with, and that's the mutual exclusive issue, the mutual exclusivity.
What's the definition of rape?
Penetration.
Does it exclude specifically sexual contact?
I don't believe the rape definition does. I believe the sexual contact definition excludes rape. Sexual contact, if I can recall this off memory, is any touching of the breasts, genital, anus, not amounting to rape. And I believe the way the definition reads. The sexual contact definition excludes rape. I would agree with counsel that you cannot be charged with rape and sexual contact and use the same set of facts to prove those two convictions. They have to be different sets of facts. In this case, there was four. Counsel misstated when he said five. There was four counts of sexual contact. I think when you review the record, it's clear that all four of those counts were supported by separate individual facts. The first two, the victim testified that the molestation started at some point in her bedroom. The defendant came in, started touching her breast area over her clothes. She ended that contact, moved to the end of her bed. Defendant made the conscious choice to then reinitiate the contact. It's the state's position that those facts support two separate charges of sexual contact. You know, the intervening act of her ending the contact, the defendant's conscious choice to reinitiate the crime or a second crime. The third charge of sexual contact we feel is supported by the information, what the defendant testified to, that or the victim testified to, that at one point the defendant came into her room and put his hand down her pants. And I think defense counsel alluded to that. There was no testimony of penetration. And in defense counsel brief, he argues that because of that, that can equal sexual contact. But my position is that without penetration, it's certainly sexual contact. And if there had been penetration testified to, you know, it would support a charge of rape. So the third charge is definitely supported. The most questionable in my mind, but I still think supportable charge of sexual contact, is a statement about hand jobs. The defense counsel stated that there's no testimony taken as to what a hand job is. There's no judicial notice as to what a hand job is. I don't know if that's necessary. I think most people understand what it is.
Was it a claim that he had her do a hand job on him?
Yes. I believe the question was...
And there was evidence of that?
I believe the question was by the prosecutor whether anything else occurred besides having sex with the defendant. And she stated yes, hand jobs, oral sex, blow jobs. I think that's the phrase. Unfortunately, for my position, that's all that was testified to. I feel that that's enough to support a sexual contact charge. It's certainly on the record as to the ages of the victim and the defendant, their family relationship. You have testimony, again, accepting the general definition of hand job, that speculating most people understand that it was definitely sexual contact. In looking at all four of these charges, it's also important to remember that the motion for directed verdict was made at the end of the state's case. The trial court specifically said on the record, paraphrasing, no, I think the state has put enough into evidence to allow all the charges to go to the jury. The trial court could have, if he felt that, you know, all the charges weren't supported, could have kicked some of those charges loose. Again, I haven't polled the members of the state's bench, but I know it's fairly common that trial judges keep a record during trial of, you know, what is brought into evidence and what the charges are. I'm going to give Judge Davis the benefit of the doubt that he understood what the charges were and compared that to the evidence that came in. In my mind, that's just another piece that, you know, this, all of the charges were supported.
If the fourth one is not, would the remedy be just to eliminate the conviction on that one, on that fourth sexual contact?
If the court determines that the fourth charge of sexual contact was not supported, I think the state of law that the appropriate is that the appropriate remedy would be just remand with orders to dismiss that charge and a resentencing. I think that's where the state of the law is. I don't know that, you know, you can not have the sentence changed if you cut that charge loose.
Why don't you talk about that video, the part of the video that got in that shouldn't have? Why wasn't that prejudicial?
I think it, again, following what the trial court said, as a video is played, the partial statement comes out along the lines of, by the investigator on the video says, so her friends tell me you make these sexual com, and the video is cut off there. The motion's made in chambers, and the trial judge says, yes, my ruling covered this area, but it did not, what was heard by the jury did not go to the intent of my ruling. It wasn't so much that it was prejudicial. That's what the state's attorney argued in against defense attorney's motion.
So it was the question, not an answer, that came in.
It was a partial question, and then the deputy state's attorney stopped the tape.
But stating a fact of some other bad act.
Mm-hmm. And it's not even clear. I mean, certainly the jury wasn't asked about this. It's not even clear whether the jury understood that the rest of the word was supposed to be comments. They heard the word sexual and then com. It's not even clear, possibly not even clear what the jury heard, whether they understood that.
Did the trial court admonish the jury at that point at any to disregard part of it, or how did the trial court handle it?
I believe the trial court after stating that the statement wasn't prejudicial and didn't violate his order, just denied defendant's motion. I don't remember from the record that the jury was admonished as to the issue. Again, if an admonishment is made, you bring up the issue of highlighting the issue for the jury, which the defense probably wouldn't have wanted anyway.
What kind of order was entered about the defendant appearing in his street clothes rather than prison garb?
I don't know if there's a specific order. The record states, when the trial judge is talking about this issue, the record states that that I believe the trial court said everybody does their best to not show these sort of transport issues. The trial court went on to say this was a miscommunication between myself and the bailiff. I was trying to get the defendant out of the courtroom without the jury seeing him. The bailiff misunderstood our signals and started to release the jury while the defendant was waiting for the elevator, I believe. I think it was that four jurors got out of the room. The bailiff realized, wait, this shouldn't be happening. They were brought back into the room. He reported at the trial court. Defense counsel at trial also brought it to the attention of the trial court. And then the trial court essentially stated it was an accident. We were attempting to take precautions to make sure this didn't happen. Signals got crossed. And unfortunately,
that doesn't excuse the prejudice of it, if there was any.
Well, I don't think there was
prejudice. How did the court address the prejudice of it? Not how, why it happened, but the prejudice of it.
Well, in addressing the prejudice, the only thing the court stated, well, there never was a motion by the defense counsel at trial regarding this. All the court stated is, it doesn't seem to me that the jury made much of it or it had much effect on the jury or something along those lines. I think there is case law, unfortunately the name just slipped my mind, that says the inadvertent meeting in the hallway between shackled prisoners and juror members is not prejudicial. So I don't think there is any prejudice on this issue to allow for plain error review.
Was there any other evidence in the record that the jury knew he was being held?
There was. The trial court stated during his comments on this issue that a uniformed deputy, at least one, had been in the trial in the courtroom during the entire trial. You can reasonably infer from that the jury was aware that the defendant was under some sort of custody. And I guess I would briefly like to talk about the prosecutorial misconduct issue. Again, it's the state's position that no misconduct occurred. I think when you look at the testimony of the expert witness, she testified to, yes, there was a nonspecific injury. Then she went back later on and said it's consistent with a penetrating injury. It's consistent with the history that the victim gave. During close, Mr. Brenner argued, this is a piece in the puzzle, that we have a penetrating injury. He stated that the doctor had said that this is consistent with a penetrating injury. It didn't come from a fall or some sort of infection or something else, that it was consistent with penetration. I think, that to me is just a summary of the evidence. And then Mr. Brenner at one point makes a comment, this is proof of reasonable doubt, which to me would then be the prosecutor's interpretation of what this evidence amounts to. I don't see any error there as far as misconduct on behalf of Mr. Brenner making those comments.
Now, my understanding on the cruel and unusual punishment and the sentences that were entered here, they were all maximum and they were all to run consecutively. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why, in this case, when you have a 50-year-old man, which is what the brief said he was, this amounts to life in prison, and he had, one other non-related felony before? Why isn't this cruel and unusual punishment? I mean, we take into consideration the background and the nature of the crimes and all the things that we do consider and determine whether it's disproportionate.
I don't believe it's cruel and unusual punishment. One, The defense argues it was a de facto life sentence. This is possibly true, probably true, but in essence, it is a term of years.
How many would he probably serve on this one?
I believe if you add them up, it's 175 years and whatever the parole calculations are off of that.
Which would be, what, half of it?
Yeah, half. In looking and reviewing sentencing issues, you look at the conduct, which defense admits is incredibly heinous. The jury sat through this evidence, and regardless of the number of times the defense wants to call into question the credibility of the victim, that issue is decided. The jury saw her testify and found the defendant guilty. You look at the conduct, which is appalling. She has been scarred for life. If anybody's been issued a life sentence, it's her. You also look at the past conduct. Yes, the past conduct in this case is not, it really doesn't amount to much at all. However, that's not where the review ends. You look at factors such as the character of the person, you look at rehabilitation, you look at the impact on the victim and the impact on society. And the impact on the victim is undoubtedly great, but also on society.
What didn't his psychological, though, indicate that he was not a high risk to reoffend?
It did. Something along the lines of, since this was a family member, it's unlikely that the defendant would choose to victimize somebody outside the family. I think it's important to, and the trial court touched on this in the record, and I would direct the court to please read the record. I think it, in the short time I've been doing appellate work, it is the best sentencing transcript I've seen. The court goes very thoroughly into the factors that aren't influencing his decision, the accepted theories for punishment, and then why he's reaching this. He states in there that the psychosexual report recommendations were premised on the fact that if the defendant gives up his denial, then he may be rehabilitated and things of that nature. The statement is made by the trial court. And in touching on the rehabilitation issue, I think it becomes clear when you look at the psychosexual recommendations in that context why the trial court found that there was no chance for rehabilitation. I believe at the end of his, right at the end of his sentencing comments, he says, you know, based on this, these things, you know, the only way to protect a society is to remove you from society.
Even at that, and assuming his age at either, whether it's 40 or 50, isn't he in fact, even if he is eligible for parole in half the time, isn't that in effect three life terms?
I'm bad at math. I'll take it for granted that yes, it is.
Okay, and if it is, doesn't that exceed the cruel and unusual status?
I don't think it does. I think, according to statute, the trial court is within its realm in sentencing consecutively. I haven't done the math if these were ordered concurrently, but it would obviously be much less. I think when you look at the nature of the crime, and again, the impact on the victim and society, the maximum was required. The case of the law, the state of the law is, you know, you reserve the harshest penalty for the most serious offenders. I don't think in this case an argument can be made that this was not one of the most serious incest, rape, sexual contact cases that the state has seen. I think the maximum penalty was certainly deserved in this case.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Utzman, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I would like to address a few of the just dates so we can come to a correct 180-day calculation. He was appeared before a magistrate judge on June 24, 2004. He was incarcerated the entire time period. There were not any motions filed except for the motion to change judges from Judge Tice to Judge Davis, which is 7 days. Until January 21st of 2005.
Now, did he make that motion? Did the defense
yes.
make that motion?
Yes, the defense made that motion, and I added that 7 days in to get to the December 28th date.
So Mr. Groff made the motion for his client?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Yep, and that was excluded. And that's the only thing that happened that you can clearly say from the record is excludable from the 180-day time period. With that 7 additional days, it expired December 28th as opposed to December 21st. So contrary to the state's position, there is a clear violation on the record. It's a matter of math. You add it up, you look at what the record shows did happen, and the only thing that did happen during that 180-day time period was the motion to have Judge Tice recuse himself. And I'd also like to touch on prejudice on the showing of the videotape, prejudice of showing Mr. Buchholz in prison garb, shackled in front of the jury. There were no admonishments to the jury on either issue. There was not even an issue raised to defense counsel. Well, what would you like me to do with this, defense counsel? Do you want me to admonish the jury on the failure of the state to redact the videotape? And you can tell by reading the transcript that the judge was not happy at all the fact that was heard by the jury. He castigated the state's attorney's office for not being prepared and not having the videotape redacted properly. And you could tell he was close to granting the motion just by the tenor of what he said. If this happens, I'm definitely granting a mistrial. Be prepared, don't let this happen again, essentially. But again, there was no admonishment to the jury, nothing to decrease the prejudicial effect of the state's error and failure to redact the video to allow at least part, the substantive part of the precluded prior bad act evidence from coming in. Same thing with him being seen by the jury shackled in prison guard. No admonishment to the jury, no question as to defense counsel as to what would, or state for that matter, what would you like me to do with this fact, other than we try to eliminate the error when we can, but it mistakenly occurred. It's not Mr. Buchholz's fault that it occurred. And it sure can't be said that it didn't prejudice him. Sure, the jury could have drawn the inference that he was in custody, but it was pointed out to him black and white that he was in custody when they see him in shackles. And this court has certainly not condoned that in the past and has stated that the state has a definite burden of making sure that the defendant receives a fair trial, and that when defendants are seen by the jury in prison garb shackled, that denies them a right to a fair trial.
They know he's the defendant. How does it deny him the right to a fair trial?
I'm sorry, what?
The jury knows he's the defendant. He's charged with the crime. So how does an inadvertent glimpse of him in prison garb deny him a fair trial?
Because it reinforces the fact that he's a dangerous person that needs to be in custody, that the state is perceiving him as a dangerous person. He can't be allowed to walk side a prison guard without being shackled.
But what would you have, if you were defending at that moment and that happened, I mean, would you ask the judge to admonish the jury about that? I mean, doesn't that just reinforce the whole thing in the jurors' minds?
I think I would, because it can't get any worse. I want something from the judge saying, this is not to be considered as evidence. He's in custody. He is being tried with a crime. But do not take the fact that he was shackled into consideration in making your determination. Because otherwise, it's just left hanging there, and the jury certainly will draw the conclusion, or certainly can draw the conclusion, he's a dangerous individual. They have to keep control of them even when they're walking down the hall. And going it back into the violation of the Eighth Amendment, the other thing that we have focused on an oral argument today is the character of Mr. Buchholz. He was armed, served this nation, the armed forces, for the full 20 years. I think it was even over 20. No prior criminal history that related to any type of this behavior. Like I said, the one theft charge was the only prior criminal history.
Did that result in a felony or a misdemeanor?
I'm sorry, I don't remember. And Mr. Buchholz, on the point of rehabilitation, he's in a catch-22. He's, like I say, he adamantly denies that this happened. He believes that the state didn't do an adequate investigation. They didn't go into his house and search his house to disprove physical evidence. They didn't interview people that they should have interviewed. They essentially stopped after their interview, after they interviewed one person who basically said, you know, Andrew Buchholz made a statement that, you know, I know how to take you out. I understand that the jury found him guilty, but there's errors that were made that they certainly may have come to a different conclusion had those errors not been made, and we wouldn't be here today. Unless the court has any other questions.
Guess not. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.